All right, I'll go around and say greet people, starting with Peter, Katie, Shane, Tyler, Sam, Susan, Paul, Marv, Mark, Bob K, Karen, John, Jill, Drew, Jim, Joan, Gathel, and Franklin. All right. Oh, let me turn my light up a little bit. Let's see. I don't. Let's see. Oh, yes, I do have announcements. So this Sunday, my Dharma brother Kakamyo will be giving the Dharma talk. So come on Sunday. Dharma talk is 11:15 to 12:15. He's the abbot of Dharma Rain Zen Center, so it's pretty cool to be able to get him to come and spend time with us. And yeah, I don't know what he's going to talk about yet. It'll be a surprise. And consider joining us for Rohatsu. It'll be an online retreat this year, just the first week of December. And there's information on the website, and hopefully you're also subscribed to our newsletter, which goes out every week, which keeps you up to date on what's happening. If you're not signed up to that, you can easily sign up through the website. And in that newsletter, we are soliciting pictures of people's altars. I thought in this time of COVID and isolation, it might be fun to see people's altars. So if you wouldn't mind, take a picture of your altar, send it to info@brightwayzen.org, the basic Brightway Zen number. You can find it on the website. Maybe with a little explanation, if you have any, about, where did your statue come from? Why did you pick it? Or if it's a statue, or if it's a rock, or what other kind of items you've chosen to put on there. So yeah. Anybody else think of anything else we should announce? Okay. So tonight we're continuing with our The World Could Be Otherwise by Norman Fisher. And this is the second part of the chapter on the perfection of ethical conduct. So we'll be starting with regret and repentance. Let's see, and I wanted to link to our precepts on the website. So just today, so we have a page on the website about Zen vows, receiving the precepts and becoming a Buddhist, and there's a link to the precepts. So I added today on this precepts page, which I'm going to drop into the chat, there's a link to a PDF that you can read. You can read it just on the web page if you want, but there's you can also link to a PDF, and there's also a PDF for printing. If you and many people already have this little booklet, but the PDF for printing means you can print it double-sided and then make a little booklet. So I was wondering, because Norman has a great section on regret and repentance, but those of us who, are familiar with our version of the precepts, I thought it would be nice to revisit the gateway of contrition, our way of describing this. So, is there somebody, so you don't have to listen to my voice all the time, is there somebody out there who has pulled this up on their screen who wouldn't mind reading just the Gateway of Contrition part? Go ahead, don't be shy.
I have it here.
Ah, all right, go ahead.
Okie dokie. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. The Gateway of Contrition. Because of their limitless compassion, the Buddhas and Dharma ancestors have flung wide the gates of compassion to all living things. Although karmic consequence is inevitable at some point in the three periods of time, contrition brings freedom and immaculacy. As this is so, let us be utterly contrite before the Buddhas. May the Buddhas and ancestors have compassion upon us. Help us see the obstacle of suffering we have inherited from the limitless past, and lead us in such a way that we share the merit that fills the universe. For they in the past were as we are now, and we will be as they in the future. All my past and harmful karma, born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. A contrite heart is open to the Dharma and finds the gateway to the precepts clear and unobstructed. Bearing this in mind, we should sit up straight in the presence of the Buddha and make this act of contrition wholeheartedly.
Thank you. So I was wondering, and I won't wait that long, no pressure, but just if anybody here who has worked with the precepts as we present them in Zen and worked with this whole idea of contrition and the karmaverse and all that, whether you have any stories to share about your relationship with this. Or maybe it isn't about even Buddhism or something. Maybe it's outside of that. Maybe it was before you got involved in Zen. But your relationship to contrition over the course of your life or your Buddhist practice. I didn't know if anybody had any interesting tale. I think many of us come from or have been influenced by religious traditions that focus on guilt or shame or, you know, some sense of human inadequacy, sin, need for purification or improvement. So some of us have something of a negative or at least wary response. When we first encounter the Gateway of Contrition. however, this is not at all how we actually hold contrition. So this, as indicated in this verse, so we sit up straight in the presence of the Buddha. And a contrite heart is open to the Dharma and finds the gateway to the precepts clear and unobstructed. So as usual, this is always about, you know, in Buddhism, there's nobody, there's no God, there's no, or I mean, maybe there is, but it's not dependent on a God. So there's no God that we're trying to please. There's no external source of authority that is judging us. So this is all about our own practice, our own choices. So when we say we through contrition, we find the gateway to ethical conduct clear and unobstructed. You might ask, what would be obstructing us from ethical conduct? And that would be, all I can think of is our own unwillingness to face what we have done, or take responsibility, or our own unwillingness to seek another way. so that gateway of contrition, it's like, there's other ways to put this, right? You can't make any progress unless you admit you have a problem. Unless you recognize that there's something you want to change, something you want to take responsibility for, you want to seek another way, then there's really, that is the gateway to your practice, and that's the gateway to practicing the precepts. So, my own story when I was 24, the sweet young age of 24, and encountered Zen. I felt quite neurotic. I felt quite dysfunctional, that there were ways that I would behave and ways that I would think and ways that I would speak that's not really how I wanted to be, but it didn't seem like I could do anything about it. And nobody had any good suggestions for me. So it just seemed very frustrating. So in a way, this doesn't have to be confessable sins. I remember I was briefly a Catholic, and when you go in for confession, it's like, I say, what did I do? It's like, you need to think, like, come up with some kind of nugget of, like, I did this and I was snapped at somebody or something. So sometimes it's difficult to do that, but we might still have a general sense of inadequacy, a general sense of life not working quite right, of not living in accord with our own aspirations. So out of that, what we call the Bodhi mind, the mind that seeks the way, arises. It's out of that dissatisfaction, in a way, says there's got to be a better way. But our Kyoji Kaimon verses also reflect something else that Fisher talks about, which is the emptiness of karma. When we say, where did it all begin? So in our confession verse, in our karma verse, all my past and harmful karma, born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. So it's beginningless. Where did it come from? there's no tracing it back. A lot of what we ended up with is from our parents, right? Or from our culture, or, we've been influenced by so many things, and, hurt, closed down people have led us to be hurt and closed down. So it's just an endless cycle. So there's greed, hate, and delusion, just a cycle of it out there. And there's no one place to put the blame. And in a way, that's a good thing, because then what? But it's a process. However we got here, this is where we are. We've ended up, and we're going to take responsibility. So I wanted to do an exercise, which also involves somebody reading from that Kyoji Kaimon, as I thought about, okay, I'm going to send people to breakout rooms and I'm going to ask you to confess your sins. I don't really see people being thrilled about that. But one of the things that we recommend with this particular, these particular verses of the precepts is Kyoji Kaimon practice is at the end of the day to simply, read this booklet or read these 10 grave precepts, which we'll cover. And without really trying to necessarily, analyze the day or literally reflect on the day, just reading them, noticing anything that might come up. So a lot, sometimes you'll hear a precept and, I don't know, it wasn't that big a problem today or something. But then something else, just notice, do not become intoxicated. And then there might be just a little bit of tightness or a little bit of sadness, or maybe something will occur to you that has been challenging you in that particular area. So this is just to basically be calling the precepts through our mind by listening to them, and then paying attention to whatever arises. So it's a practice of precept mindfulness, if you will. So someone else who either has the precept booklet or has it up online, would you be willing to read just the 10 grave precepts, starting with do not kill, cultivate and encourage life, and to read them with a little bit of a pause in between? Volunteer. I'll just pick on somebody I know has a computer.
Are they in this book?
No. Oh, okay. No, I put a link in the chat to the web page where they are.
I can do it if everyone's quiet. I didn't want to jump in too quick.
Go ahead.
All right. That is just so I'm sure, because I'm all pretty new. It's the having taken refuge, we embrace in the three pure precepts.
Oh. Start a little further with the do not kill. And then at the end,
do not kill, do not steal. Yeah.
Do not defame the three treasures, and read the verses after that. But then, and you know, don't read the last kind of closing section.
All right. If I keep going, just tell me to be quiet. All right. Do not kill. Cultivate and encourage life. In the realm of the everlasting Dharma, holding no thought of killing is the precept of not killing. The life of Buddha increases with life. No life can be cut off. Continue the life of Buddha. Do not kill the Buddha. Do not steal. Honor the gift not yet given. In the realm of the unattainable Dharma, holding no thought of gain is the precept of not stealing. The self and the things of the world are just as they are. The mind and its object are one. The gateway to enlightenment stands open wide. Do not misuse sexuality. Remain faithful in relationships. In the realm of the ungilded Dharma, not coveting or creating a veneer of attachment is the precept of not misusing sexuality. The three wheels are pure and clear. When there is nothing to desire, we follow the way of all Buddhas. Do not speak dishonestly. Communicate truthfully. In the realm of the inexplicable Dharma, putting forth not one word is the precept of not speaking dishonestly. The Dharma wheel turns from the beginning. There is neither surplus nor lack. The sweet dew covers the earth, and within it lies the truth. Do not become intoxicated. Polish clarity, dispel delusion. In the realm of the intrinsically pure Dharma, not harboring delusion is the precept of not becoming intoxicated. We are naturally pure. There is nothing to be deluded about. This is enlightenment itself. Understand this truly, and no intoxicants can be taken in. Do not dwell on past mistakes. Create wisdom from ignorance. In the realm of the flawless Dharma, not expounding upon error is the precept of not dwelling on past mistakes. In the Buddha Dharma, there is one path, one Dharma, one realization, one practice. Do not engage in fault-finding. Do not condone haphazard talk. Do not praise self or blame others. Maintain modesty, extol virtue. In the realm of the equitable Dharma, not dwelling upon I versus you is the precept of not praising self or blaming others. All Buddhas and ancestors realize the empty sky and the great earth. When they manifest the noble body, there is neither inside nor outside in emptiness. When they manifest the Dharma body, not even a speck of dust is seen upon the ground. Do not be mean with Dharma or wealth. Share understanding. Give freely of self. In the genuine, all-pervading Dharma, being jealous of nothing is a precept of not being mean with Dharma or wealth. One phrase, one verse, that is the 10,000 things and 100 grasses, one Dharma, one realization, that is all Buddhas and Dharma ancestors. From the beginning, not one thing has been begrudged. Do not indulge anger. Cultivate equanimity. In the realm of the selfless Dharma, not contriving reality for the self is the precept of not indulging anger. Not advancing, not retreating, not real, not empty. There is a brilliant sea of clouds. There is a dignified sea of clouds. Do not defame the three treasures. Respect the Buddha, unfold the Dharma, nourish the Sangha. In the realm of the One, holding no concept of ordinary beings and sages is the precept of not defaming the three treasures. To do something by ourselves without copying others is to become an example to the world, and the merit of this becomes the source of all wisdom. Criticize nothing, accept everything.
Thank you. Any reflections? Was that like?
It's not so much a reflection as it is a comment. I haven't revisited the precepts, I think, since February, so it was a good, it was refreshing and re-energizing to visit them again.
The going through the list, when the when they light up, they don't light up in some binary way like there's that one was a problem today. There's this sort of nebulous, well, there was a thing today, but was it intoxication or anger? Like they both kind of light up a bit. And it's always interesting to take that as a challenge and try and dig into what that sense is. The way that I just sort of rolled out of the wrong side of the bed today and was in a very cynical, grumpy frame of mind, and everything was broken and everything was dumb, and it snowballed on itself.
What comes to mind for me is all the things I need to work on. I never think about, I'm good at that, or, I did a really good job with this one, but I always think about, not doing too well on that one, I messed up on that one today, didn't I? I need to turn it I did great on Do Not Kill. Or I cultivated life. But then I'll think of but I did kill that person's idea. Or, I don't know how to get it to what did I do well today? Kind of like a, is that Saturday Night Live, Mr., you know, I'm good, I'm popular, you know, what was that guy's name? I can't remember. And I, gosh darn it, people like me, I need to do it that way, you know, not, ugh, God, I'm failing in this. Oh yeah, that one was a good one. I don't know. Does anybody have any, well, I don't know. Later on, if anybody has any advice on how they turn it to positive versus negative, that would be helpful. But that's what comes to my mind.
I don't know that it's really meant to be an upper. I guess it feels like, I mean, I noticed like when there's not something negative arising, that's nice. Like, oh, that's nice. That precept went by and I didn't feel I don't know. I mean, the way that Norman describes it is it's kind of like, in a way, this kind of reflection is about noticing where we feel bad. Like we notice where we've fallen short. We notice where we've caused harm and we feel some, but the positive stuff, like, we're not really meant to be taking credit for, right? Or the positive stuff is like, I cultivated so much life today. Like, I don't know. That's the way that I've related to the precepts. I don't know that it's the only way. Other thoughts?
Thanks, Tyler, for reading those. I was surprised that I was struck by non-stealing, because I haven't been anywhere where I could steal something. But the other day, after having, I can't repeat the joke here, but after that my friend told me over the phone, and it was just a spontaneous, hilarious thing that she said. And I was talking with another friend later, and I found myself stealing that joke almost verbatim, because the conversation got to a place where, yeah. So I heard myself steal this joke, and I felt just really bad in my tummy. I felt gross. And so it happened quick enough to where I could correct course. And I was like, Christy, I just stole that joke. I just stole that joke from Jenny. Let me tell you what she said. So I don't know. It's, I just felt bad physically after right when I did it. So I kind of, in response to what Jill was saying, it's like the correcting course feels good. The correcting course feels more spacious than when you're stealing. And just when, I guess in general, when Tyler was reading the precepts, I was thinking about just like the Buddhist practice and concept of mindfulness versus the more popular concept, which seems like it kind of takes the ethical teeth out of it. If it's just about non-judgmental awareness of what's going on in the present right now, it kind of takes the ethics out of it in a way, because I feel like, yeah, mindfulness is anchored in how we're feeling in the present, but we're connecting it to what we have been doing before to bear that fruit, you know? So I just wanted to make that general comment too.
Who else had something to share about your precept reflections? I noticed myself just feeling sad just when I'm noticing and a precept was being read that I know I've fallen short on, I haven't done well, you know, do not condone haphazard talk, and just thinking about, you know, my kind of critical conversations I might be having with somebody about another person, killing in the sense of cutting people off, just there being people in the world that I just want to reject, those various things, and then just noticing there's a sense of sadness about that, about like I don't want to be like that, I don't want to do that. So, as Fisher writes, it's good if we feel bad. If we've done something that caused harm for self or others, that's good. Like, we're wired for that. That's good feedback. So, one of my favorite writers on the precepts, Diane Rossetto, wrote Waking Up to What You Do. She calls these, like, the precepts are like beacons, like little lighthouses, you know, that might guide sailors, and they say, pay attention, look. And then, you know, you may need to change course. And when that, when we feel that kind of icky feeling or that sense of tightness or something like that, it's calling our attention, you know, it's that aid to mindfulness. Pay attention to what's happening here. But the reason that we can open up to regret and repentance without getting trapped is because we keep in mind that all things are empty of inherent, enduring, independent self-nature. So that's what we mean by emptiness. We're empty of this thing that we think should be there. I am empty of such nature. You are, the actions are. And this doesn't mean that we don't exist or that things don't matter, just that they're not fixed. So there is no inherent, enduring, independent me who is stained and burdened by my past actions. There's only this living, ever-changing being who is the result. And the result of countless past actions, my own past actions, other people's past actions, as well as many other causal factors. Now, at the same time, because of karma, so this is the cause and effect attached to volitional actions. So a lot of times we experience that as like, you know, the kind of negative stuff perhaps that have led us to be who we are, the imperfect beings that we are. But it's also because of karma that everything we do has an effect. So this is kind of a central tenet. We don't tend to go for dogma. We don't tend to go for like, here's our apostolic creed. But if we had one of them would be, you know, everything you do has an effect, which means that we can change. Maybe not, you know, dramatically, maybe not instantly, maybe not exactly how we'd hope to change. But for me, like at that, you know, that neurotic 24-year-old who felt like she couldn't make any changes, this was a big mental shift. That, like, you know, it's the drops in the bucket, right? Eventually the bucket's gonna fill up. So you have to have a certain kind of faith that the efforts to redirect the mind or change your habits or whatever, and there, it feels sometimes very incremental or like we're really taking on a big task. But the argument is everything you do has an effect, so you can change. So I might have some heavy karma. So this is one of the things that you might encounter in our practice where we kind of talk about personal karma. So this is kind of another way to use the term in the sense that, you know, you might think of it as like you have this particular karmic package right now, right? You have a body, you've got a sore shoulder, you've got a habit, you know, where you maybe drink too much, you get irritable, or, you know, whatever, like you are, you're very generous with your stuff, but not with your time, or various things that we've talked about. You're not fixed, but you've ended up with this karmic package. You've got your difficulties, you've got your strengths, and, you know, it all is just the result of a whole bunch of stuff. And some of them, so those of us that, you know, as we age, we realize, you know, all those choices we're making are adding up. What used to look like a vague, wide, you know, bunch of possibilities now looks like, oh, this is the, here's the person I've chosen to become. So some of them have to do with our own choices, but some of them don't. So just like our karma verse, which is, you know, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, where did it come from? This is one of the things that the Buddha said, to contemplate the workings of karma, to contemplate exactly how you ended up with this karmic package, will just drive you crazy. It's just, it's not worth it. I mean, that's not to say that some reflection, some counseling, some, you know, some study of yourself, it can't be useful. You know, oh, that's why. And maybe it can help you to work through some things or let some things go. But ultimately, at a certain point, we just have to like, all right, this is who and what I am. What, where do we go from here? So we may end up with bad habits or tendencies due to parents, our culture, genetics, past experiences, trauma, mental illness, etc. So a deep acceptance of our karmic package is something that is a vital part of progress on the Bodhisattva path. You know, Pema Chodron calls it start where you are, right? It's just generally in practice, if we practice really diligently and intensely, you may at some point really wake up to what a crappy and inadequate person you are. You may or may not already have such ideas about yourself. Maybe you already think that. But frankly, ideas about that and really like directly perceiving it are kind of two different things. So there was a time in my practice when I could hardly bear to say anything. I lived in a Zen community, so there was, you know, interaction was required, and I could barely stand to say anything, because like everything that came out of my mouth just seemed so, you know, self-centered or judgmental, or But then, if we keep practicing, we can also awaken to how we're not defined by all of those mistakes and inadequacies. We're defined by our willingness to practice right here and right now. Just great humility, we just start over. And I had a teacher once refer to this as joining the human race. When you recognize, okay, you're not better than everybody else, and you're not worse than everybody else. You're really not, you know, everybody's this way. Everybody is imperfect and flawed, and we just start over every moment. So, any thoughts about that stuff or about anything we've talked about so far? I'm guessing it's just late at night and dark and cold. Nobody wants to go for it.
No one wants to confess our sins, but talk a little bit. I was thinking, you know, earlier, I've spent most of the day alone. I went into the office, but people weren't there. And my wife worked late, so she didn't come home until I was sitting as I was in. I thought, well, you know, we really haven't had many opportunities to break the precepts. But that got to be thinking, you know, do you, in order to be good, do you need temptations and resist them? And thinking more deeply along that, I realized that, well, ultimately, it's not so much the, well, as much the action, but it's also the desire. If you follow the precept but still have a desire to break it, you are not really following the precept. Mm-hmm. If you lust, even in your heart, not in reality, that's desire. And we all know that that's one of the causes of suffering. So really, it's not only the following the precepts, but not even having the desire to break the precepts. Mm.
That sounds like the, like we were talking about last week, the precepts describe the behavior of a Buddha, right?
Yeah.
So what we're aiming for is not even to want it. Not even to want to break the precepts. Of course, in the, you know, at the other end of the spectrum is the, like, just at least keeping the letter of the precepts. You know, that's a start. Yeah. Act, fake it till you make it kind of thing, right? To at least kind of clean up your life.
Well, in the end, too, one of the precepts is basically don't dwell on your mistakes or past mistakes. So on one hand, you need to work toward losing the desire. On the other hand, you can't beat yourself up too much about it. Otherwise, you are, once again, violating a precept.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like the Bodhisattva vow. You know, it's an impossible vow. Well, it's impossible to follow the precepts perfectly, but you still can vow to follow them.
Well, I wanted to throw out another question. Say, this is from Fisher on page 77. He's quoting an old Buddhist scripture that mentions the ethical discipline. It says, if you cannot look after yourself because you have no ethical discipline, then your intention to take care of others is simply a joke. So, would people prefer to go into breakout rooms to talk about that or stick here?
Stay here.
All right, well, you got to talk then.
Hi, my name's Peter, and I'm willing to talk. There is two things that are coming to mind right now. One of them is about a football game. In a football game, a game is played, and then people come together and huddle, you know, whether defensively or offensively to make a play. And it seems to me that my life is so muted by the current lockdown that instead of this being the huddle, this is the game. This is the chance to come together. And it, therefore, my point is, I'm having a hard time coming up with things to say because there's not much to talk about. You know, it's like, what, how am I going to report on having been alone in my apartment all day? You know, that's, I'm not playing a game. I'm not coming back to a huddle to talk about the play that didn't take place. So that, and the other analogy might be, you know, we need to prime a pump and there's just no water in the pump. And so, you know, I like, you know, you thought back years ago when you're, you know, in your past thinking that everything you said was crap. I'm certainly experiencing the same, you know, and so I'm not going to talk for another 32 seconds at most because, you know, I'm not doing any better here. But, you know, it's just like, yeah, please share. I thank anybody for having something to say, but it's, we're having to dig into the corners to come up with, you know, where's any relevance here? Because there it is, 32 seconds.
Thank you, Peter. That's great. I was like, in some ways I was just sitting here thinking, I don't know, you know, what else can I do to make classes more exciting? Or I don't know, like what, you know, is this just, I think this is a pretty good book. I don't know, what, are people not very interested? But yeah, you may have really put your finger on something there, where we've all been living in a very surreal kind of situation, where a lot of this stuff, the precepts are about, in particular, about, they tend to come to become most relevant in interactions with other people. They're about relationships. So yeah, there's quite a few of us who have fewer fewer interactions these days. Although I spend plenty of time on Zoom with people. And it's, you know, there's stuff there too. So that, you know, if you cannot look after yourself because you have no ethical discipline. So why is ethical conduct necessary for bodhisattva practice? Or if you have something else you want to talk about, go ahead. Why is ethical conduct? I just think that's, if you basically don't have ethical discipline, your intention to take care of others is simply a joke.
I guess because then you don't do it, you know, the discipline part, I guess. I don't know. This whole section was not my favorite in his book, and it's not because he's not a good writer, but it's just that it's like, it just kind of brings up all the old, you should do this. In some ways, I like the emphasis in Buddhism on practice, and then the fact that you're always supposed to be kind of letting yourself return, you know, letting yourself return and not giving yourself grief about it. And in this particular section, it seems like you're kind of supposed to, it feels a little more judgy. And of course you have to judge, but we're so good at that. It almost seems like we don't need to emphasize it. So I know that.
And yet, is judgment necessary? I mean, when we were reading the precepts, and if you felt a kind of, you know, you felt something arise, is that judgment?
I don't know. It's like a conditioning or something. I was trying to figure out what it was. It's just kind of a heaviness. And it feels like you're sort of not, like there's nobody else in the room. You're just there with your self. No.
Well, for me, this is all kind of new. So this was the first time I had heard the precepts, and listening to Tyler read them, it felt really peaceful to me. Like, wow, you know, if I lived my life this way, it just felt really soothing to me. But for your question about in the book where it says, can you not look after yourself because you have no ethical discipline, then your intention to take care of others is simply a joke. I guess I can relate to that as being a mother of young kids a long, long time ago. And if I wasn't attempting to be ethical, you know, be a good role model for my kids, that to me would be kind of a joke. It's like, you know, not living your words. And I actually still go to work and work with people. And I have a lot of times during the day where my coworkers are driving me crazy and I want to, and we work with the public, and I want to intervene and correct what they're saying because I don't, you know, I think I could word things better than they are, you know, things like that. So for me, these precepts, just hearing them for the first time, it seems like kind of a comforting guideline of how you could just try to do things differently or do things better. And again, just having the awareness of when, like, I think we talked about this last week, where like that didn't quite feel right, like however I behaved, and just giving yourself the opportunity to do a redo or kind of step back and tell somebody, you know, I didn't really like the way that came out. This is, you know, kind of try to fix it, I guess. So it didn't seem negative to me, but I'm kind of at a shallow end right now, just hearing them for the first time.
Thank you.
I like what you said at the end, Domio, when at the end of when you're talking about the precepts and using them as like a way to like analyze it, but think about how you can change, and gives you hope. But I think I'm wondering, you know, like for me, I'm wondering if that residual like judgment, oh, I didn't do that one, or oh yeah, that one needs to be worked on. You know, like when I do that to myself and I kind of beat myself up, you know, I'm wondering if it is like that residual, like being raised in the, you know, Lutheran household and you didn't follow that and you have that judgment there. But I also like that you've said this before, but I have to like keep reminding, it's like I have to beat it out of me, but like, just be aware. Okay. Yeah. I could work on that. Like, you know, and it's okay. I'm human. Or, you know, just not giving into that, like, yeah, not that, you know, just that judgment, and just be more accepting. Or kind of like when you said before, when you said like when you're angry or upset, you'll like hug yourself or you'll hold your heart, mm-hmm. to kind of like, wow, I must be really, you know, overwhelmed. And so it's that kind of feeling of like, wow, you know, yeah, I didn't get there, but you know, I'm going to be on my way. So that's my, I like that. That's the way to turn it around for me. It is. Thank you.
Yeah.
Karen, I'm not, kind of going off of what Karen said, I'm not a mother, but my life hasn't changed too much with COVID because I work with kids in foster care. And I think the quote you read out about, you know, our actions now more so than ever are being watched, at least with the youth I work for and the students I serve. And so if I find myself kind of not practicing what I'm preaching, it definitely is noticed. And so I think the quote you read about, just, it just kind of goes back to the age old saying about our actions speak louder than our words. And this COVID has caused this great pause of our life and has actually just caused so much self-reflection for me and like, internalizing and figuring out how to navigate this world and help these students that I work with navigate the world. And so I really like that quote, and it's always a reminder before you do a certain action, you know, people are watching you. So to just make sure your morals align with your action.
Yeah, it's actually kind of nice when you have people watching you. Because if you don't have people watching you, I'm just speaking for myself, it can be more difficult. Like all my life, when I get overwhelmed, as Jill mentioned, I'll just get just, I'll just fly off the handle at some stupid little thing. Never at people. Never, ever, ever at people. But just like doorknobs and dish racks and, you know, computers and like just ah, ah. And yeah, that sense of if we have any kind of oh I don't know why I followed up Sarah's comment with that one. I would never act like that if I thought somebody was watching. It's a really weird kind of editing, you know. If I thought somebody was watching, it would be like, well, I can handle that. But you know, if there's no one watching, I can. And unfortunately, I have African gay parrots, and they're watching. I don't mentally count them, but they're watching, and they'll repeat what I say. But yeah, it's a subtle, it's a really subtle practice and a really subtle shift into how to, you know, deal with our karma, accept our karma, face our karma, and enter this gateway of contrition without adding the shame or the heaviness, the burden, the discouragement. And I think that's just part of our practice in a way, is just navigating that. And here's these precepts and here's this karma verse we recite. And I think when people hear about Zen, you know, awakening or liberation or enlightenment or something like that, I don't think most people realize how incredibly personal that awakening or that liberation is. How it ends up, it's so intimately tied to that sense of ourselves, our sense of inadequacy or incompleteness, our sense of struggle and unworthiness or worthiness, you know, because it's always just kind of a flip side, right? Sometimes we're worthy, sometimes we're not. And coming to this profound just self-acceptance and embrace, which the practice really can get us there. And it really is, it goes hand in hand with deepening our sense of what emptiness really is. Because our small self is irredeemable in a way. It's just like this flawed vessel. But our empty self is full of potential. And I remember sitting many, I don't know how long, it felt like years, just sitting utterly, you know, I'm vacillating between arrogance and utter self-loathing. They usually go together. you might tread in the middle a little bit, but you know, if you really try hard and you succeed, but then sometimes you fail and then you're miserable. I just remember just sitting in such dejection for so long and just thinking like, I'm never going to be able to make it. That guy sitting next to me, he'll make it, but I'm not going to make it. I'm just going to be a shitty person for the rest of my life. But I didn't have one big opening, one big like, oh, now I see the whole Buddha land. But it came in little shifts, but significant shifts. Little shifts of feeling like I am in the Lotus Sutra, where the Buddha, everybody's lining up to get their prediction of Buddhahood. And everybody wants to hear the Buddha say their name. Mark, in so many years, you're going to be reborn, and then you're going to become enlightened. You're going to become Buddha so-and-so, and you're going to have a Buddha land that looks like this. And everybody wants to hear their name. And I think that's so amazing. That's like a 2,000-year-old scripture with people in it that needed that kind of affirmation, like, I am okay. So he never said, like, well, not you, you're not gonna cut it. Eventually there's this sense like every one of us has the potential, every one of us is we're not, because we don't have that inherently existing independent self nature, it cannot be stained. All right. Well, thank you all for being here. It's 9 o'clock. I'll say we dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Have a good rest of your evening.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank
you. Good night, kitty cat.
Yeah.
What's his name again?
Goose.
Goose.
Hi, Goose.
Sorry if I distracted you, Domio.
Oh, with what?
That comment.
Oh, yeah. I cannot, when they're, the chat, if I'm talking, I'm like,
I apologize. Oh my God,
you African. he thought he heard me say I had African gay parents.
That's what I thought. But then I remember that you said you had parrots before and the idea that they could repeat. It's like, whoa.
I do have African gay parents and they're always around listening.
They're so like that.
Oh, that's so weird.
Good night.
Oh, good night all.
Good night all.